Attention, pleasure seekers. What if I told you there was a toy that was so iconic that it practically set the standard for all my favorite products? Allow me to introduce or reintroduce to you the Magic Wand. Dubbed the Cadillac of Vibrators, the Magic Wand is more than just a toy. It's a culture icon, a symbol of power and unapologetic pleasure. I mean, do you know any other toys that have been praised in Time magazine? Didn't think so. With a unique rumble that resonates deep within, the Magic Wand Original is not just a product, it's a trusted confidant. And it's a sure thing. Never had an orgasm? Try a magic wand. Never given your party a full body massage? Try the magic wand. Listen, it's rightfully earned accolades like Vibrator of the Year for decades. I've been so obsessed with my magic wand, I even drilled holes in my bedside table so that she's always next to me in case I need her. Well, that was years ago. Because now there are multiple iterations of the magic wand, allowing you to pick whatever model fits your lifestyle. You can go wireless with the magic wand rechargeable, tiny with the magic wand mini, or micro. Micro's really mini. Or go for variety with the Magic Wand Plush. The best part though, all of them have the same powerful orgasmic rumble that made the original so popular. So if you're ready to make some magic, visit sexwithemily.com/magicwand and discover why the Magic Wand continues to cast a spell on the world. Magic Wand, not just a vibrator, an icon of pleasure. Okay, real talk. We all have embarrassing moments in the bedroom, you know, like gas, bloating, indigestion, and more. And I hear from so many of you with stomach issues, and it's keeping you from the pleasure you so rightly deserve. Well, I got some great news. While studies show that gut issues directly impact our arousal, erections, and overall sexual health, I got a game changer for your overall wellness. Introducing Just Thrive Probiotic. It is my secret weapon for overall health and the fuel for my sex life. Just Thrive Probiotic isn't just any ordinary probiotic. It is a clinically proven game changer, a gut superhero designed to up-level your passion and sex life. So no more embarrassing moments, only a life of gut-powered ecstasy. That sounds good, right? It's the first probiotic formulated with four ancestral survival strains, clinically guaranteed to reach your gut 100% alive. This probiotic is like your personal gut gardener, maintaining the health of your gut by eliminating bad bacteria that causes all those digestive issues and replenishing the good, making it a game changer for your digestion, your immune system, your skin, and even your mood. With Just Thrive, you'll nourish your gut microbiome, fueling your mind, body, and soul. So say hello to increased libido, enhanced pleasure, and a whole new level of satisfaction. Oh, don't miss my episode, Why Gut Health is Sexy with Tina Anderson, where you can learn more about this groundbreaking company. For a limited time, you can try Just Thrive 100% risk-free by visiting justthrivehealth.com and enter promo code SEXWITHEMILY at checkout to save 20% off on a 90-day bottle of Just Thrive probiotic. So take charge of your gut health, take charge of your sex life, and live your healthiest life yet with Just Thrive.
Is the effort equal? You know, do you send someone, it's fine to send someone a text in the morning and say, hey, I hope you have a great day today. You know, how are you this morning? It's okay to send that text. Don't send it the next 3 days. Let's see if they do the same.
Right.
Look into his eyes. They're the eyes of a man obsessed by sex. Eyes that mock our sacred institutions. Bedroom eyes, they call them in a bygone day.
You're listening to Sex with Emily. I'm Dr. Emily, and I'm here to help you prioritize your pleasure and liberate the conversation around sex. On this show, I'm joined by relationship and life coach, author, and YouTube personality, Matthew Hussey. We discuss whether or not casual dating actually exists, why rejection is actually a good thing, how dating apps have changed the dating world, and how to actually meet people in real life, and the root cause of problematic dating patterns. Oh, P.S., make sure you subscribe to our podcast because Friday is part two of this interview and things get juicy. All right, intentions with Emily. For each episode, join me in setting an intention. What do you want to get out of listening to this episode? Well, I set one, and my intention is to give you a very practical look into what makes relationship work and what gets in the way of building a great partnership. We have a new article on our site, which is an Ask Emily. How do I tell a new partner about my fantasies? Okay, guys, remember, wherever you listen, We love when you rate and review the podcast. It totally helps us. And finally, if you want a question answered, just call my hotline, 559-TALK-SEX, or 559-825-5739, or just message me, sexwithemily.com/askemily. All right, everybody, enjoy this episode. Matthew Hussey's here, and in your YouTube and podcast feeds to show you the ins and outs of love. At 34, he's demystifying dating in the modern world. In addition to hosting in-person retreats, his book, Get the Guy, was a New York Times bestseller, and he has millions of followers on social media with almost 400 million views on YouTube. Matthew's goal is to make women feel empowered. Welcome to the show, Matthew Hussey.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about what my goal is, because when people ask me, what's your mission? What are you trying to do? And this might sound quite a philosophical start, but I think life is hard, and I like helping people feel less lonely in the process, whether it's because they're single and they want to be with someone, but they haven't met anyone yet, which can be really hard, or whether they're just going through difficult emotional issues and challenges in their lives. And I've built a career on putting out my ideas online in videos. And really, more than I want to find someone a relationship, I want to help someone be less lonely in life. And I don't see them as the same thing.
Because we are the epidemic of loneliness right now, right? And it's gotten even worse probably during the pandemic. So less lonely. But I want to back up for a minute, though, because you started working with men initially, right? Mm. And then you started working with women at such a young age, and just thinking about, like, what was it where you're like, oh, I could help these women? What were the questions that you were like, I got this. I'm going to help them. I'll tell
you, here's what gave me some early confidence. Yeah. I was working with a lot of men. It was like over a 3-year period, it was close to 10,000 men I worked with.
God.
And I got to the point where I realized, well, women were asking me, can you do the same thing for us? Because they were hearing about me. And at the time I thought, well, I don't know.
I'm trying to figure it out.
I don't know you, but I do know guys. I know myself. And I'd learned quite a lot about human dynamics at that point. So I said, I could talk to you about guys. And they were like, great. Like, let's
so
do that.
Know,
we
right?
don't need to know about us. We want to know about men. The first thing I did was I actually picked up some major books that were written for women in their dating lives. And that actually gave me confidence.
You're
that
like,
I had
do
something
than...
to bring.
So what, like the rules, or what were you reading then? It was like...
One of them was the rules.
The rules. Oh,
One of
God.
Them was the rules. I suppose I was interested to learn at that time that was a kind of seminal book.
Right.
That had been out there for some time and was a huge bestseller. And, you know, I was interested in the lessons from that. And in all sorts of things I was reading, not just that book, but there were just a lot of things that I thought, that doesn't feel true to me
as a man. Let's talk about that. So what was the advice? Because when I think about the rules and the advice, then it was like, wait for him to call, never be available on a Friday if he's calling you for the weekend. You know, they should call by Wednesday. Mm-hmm. You know, be busy, don't answer, don't be needy. What was wrong about all the advice then?
You know,
what do you teach?
And by the way, I will say this, because if I were the people who wrote the rules watching me right now, I'd be annoyed in the same way as someone watching my old videos,
right.
You know, says, I watched a bunch of Matthew Hussey videos, and there's a whole bunch of ways I disagree with him. Well, there's a whole bunch of ways I disagree with myself too.
Yeah.
When I look back on my old content, there's a lot of stuff I'm like, I wouldn't say that anymore.
No, I'm the same. I have them edited like, oh, did I say that? Like, I cringe.
Yeah.
I get
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So I don't want to paint a picture of kind of going after anyone's work in that way, unless I really can't stand it. But, you know, there was one particular message in that book, which is, if he's not approaching you, then he's not interested. And that almost was like at the core of what I knew not to be true for me and so many people, because I had actually spent most of my life avoiding the very people I was interested in.
Because of fear, anxiety, rejection.
You asked me to help a 92-year-old lady across the street with her bags. I could do that any day of the week.
Right.
But at that time in my life, as a teenager especially, if you'd have asked me to go and talk to the woman I actually was attracted to, that was tantamount to death.
Yeah.
Or if you got rejected, and for most men, that persists in their lives. You know, that we can all, most men, if they're honest, can associate with having a lot of nerves about walking over to a woman that they find really attractive. So it appeared to me that actually the very inverse of that advice was true.
Okay.
That the more you like someone, the less likely it was that you would go over there and approach them.
Okay.
Now, that's changed actually a little bit, because now with dating apps, you can approach with relative ease.
Right.
Knowing that the rejection doesn't sting nearly as bad as walking up to someone in a coffee shop or a bar. You do that, and that's real social rejection.
Are people approaching, are you encouraging people to do that anymore, to go up to people and...
Well, as if we needed another spanner in the works for that. As if we needed another thing that would make that difficult. You know, we already...
Pandemic, the masks.
We already had dating apps, which have stripped most of us of our social skills.
Right.
Right. Because now I can just interact with lots and lots of people with no real repercussions. I don't have to get good at talking to people.
Right.
I don't have to get brave. Of course, we still have to go on a date, and that's the part most people forget.
Right.
But on top of that, now you have a pandemic that has made us, at the very least, awkward,
right?
Trickier. But I still think people should do it. I still think we should take the small step to say something in person. And if I could give people one piece of advice on meeting people in person, it's say something instead of nothing.
Okay.
Because so often we get in our heads and we think, I've got to say the perfect thing. I've got to somehow win this person over. I've got to seduce them with one powerful line.
Yeah.
But what most people actually need is a green light for an interaction, whether it's man or a woman.
Okay.
We need a green light for an interaction. We're looking for that cue from somebody else that it's okay to invest a little of ourselves. It's kind of like walking down the street. If you walk down the street and a stranger smiles at you, doesn't matter, man, woman, young, old, whatever. If a stranger smiles at you, in that moment, you're quite likely to smile back. And it's not that you didn't want to smile. It's that you were waiting for them to smile.
Right.
Because you don't want to be the weirdo smiling at the stranger and they don't smile. Now, a lot of us, by the way, this is what's kind of interesting about life, is we walk down the street, we walk past someone and someone smiles at us. And by the time we've registered that they smiled at us and we want to smile back, they're already past us.
It's true. Just have a smile on your face, right?
Yeah, well, that's the
practice.
Thing. That's exactly it.
How do we do that?
By having a standard for yourself that has nothing to do with other people. If you have a standard of warmth, like I think about this a lot. Sometimes I told you before this, I'm introverted, right? By nature, but I've learned how to be an extrovert when I need it. And I'm a big believer in, before I go to a party, or I was just at an event in Connecticut where I was around a lot of people. Even to this day, I have to sometimes really psych myself up for those situations, because I'm like, oh God, I've got to go and interact with a whole bunch of people and do small talk and do this, that. Some of that is just the effort of it all and the fact that I don't love small talk.
Right.
Who does, really? But some of it is ego too. It's, oh God, I'm going to be in this room and I don't know anyone, and am I going to feel special, and am I going to feel like I'm standing there and I don't know anyone, it's going to be hard to talk. There's still that kid in me that feels that way. Now, as an adult and as someone who does what I do, I also have the tools. So that's really handy. And one of the psychological tools I use for myself before I go into that room is I want to have a standard for the warmth that I give.
Okay.
That has nothing to do with how warm this room is. Because we go into a room looking for warmth, looking for someone who's going to unlock our loving, compassionate, warm, friendly side. And if we actually instead take responsibility for unlocking other people's warm, compassionate, friendly side, then we will have a magnetic effect everywhere we go. Instead of going to a room to be changed, we go into a room to change the room.
Mm-hmm. That's such a good practice. That's so true. Because I'm thinking about, we're talking about like dating, should you approach, should you not? And how approachable are you? Like when you go to a bar, I mean, back in the day before we were all obsessed with our phones, you'd be with a friend or you'd be looking around. You had to. You couldn't be on your phone. But now we're all on our phones. You don't even realize that your body language is shutting off. You're not approachable. So people are like, oh, no one ever hits on me. No one ever talks to me. And I think, how do we recognize what we're doing that's making us not very approachable? And how do we become more so if we want to meet someone?
I do think that we have to almost reverse engineer it and say, what are the things that when people do them make me feel endeared to that person? What makes me feel like I'm comfortable with another human being? And then really look at yourself and say, be really, really honest. Am I doing any of those things when I walk into a room, you know, or when I go into a restaurant with a bar am I looking up? Like simple things. Am I actually looking up and at the room? Or is my head in my phone? And we know most people's heads are in their phones, not because there's anything that interesting there.
It's really not.
It's because they're, it's a comfort blanket. It's smoking, you know? It's like smokers kind of look cool and indifferent because they always have something to do. People on their phones, it's the same thing. It's like, no, I'm not. Look at me. I'm not a loser. I have something to do.
Right.
I'm checking Instagram posts of people I don't know.
Exactly. Do you ever look somewhere around and everyone's on their phone and they're always on Instagram? Like you just look to the left, to the right.
Yeah, because it's you know, I'd be the last person on earth to say how addictive it is. But I'm getting lost in this mosaic of lives and stimuli and colors and patterns and aesthetics and moments, none of which are my life. None of which are the room that I'm actually in. None of which are the people that I'm actually surrounded by. You know, you've got someone who is surrounded by other people, but looking down in their phone saying, I can't meet anyone. It first is about lifting our gaze to the world that's actually around us, to the world that we're actually inhabiting, opening up our body language to the room. What we do is we go and find a corner of the room or a table, and we close off to the room, and everything points inwards, and we close our space down. Yeah. We're in this big room with lots of people, and then we close our space down and our energy down. And it becomes a really brave thing someone has to do to come over, turn you around, lift your gaze up from your phone, and try and say something.
Right.
If the way that you are with your body language and where your eyes are looking and what you're doing is something that requires someone else to be disproportionately brave to come over, that's why you're not being approached.
Right.
You want to lower the amount of bravery required for someone to talk to you.
And even not even just if you're sitting up, because people might be saying, well, I don't sit in bars or I don't sit anywhere. But even when I'm going through the airport, I'm just out walking down the street. In my neighborhood, I really make an effort just not to be on my phone, just to be observing what's going on around me. Because there's always potential to meet people if that's what you're looking for.
But there is an openness and a warmth to you. You know, such small things. This is why it's hard. It can be hard to teach for the very reason that these things are subtle.
I know.
You know, it's hard to tell people who watch your podcast, Emily's a great hugger.
Yeah.
They don't know. But I walk in, you give me a hug, and you're a great hugger.
I thought you were a great hugger.
But there's a warmth and a feeling of like, oh, this is someone who's comfortable in their skin.
Yeah.
This is someone who's comfortable with affection. This is someone who's open. And all of that you get from a hug. And in that moment, you go, oh, we're going to get on.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
We're going to get on. This is going to be easy. All from that moment.
Mm-hmm.
It's an openness and in a way a vulnerability.
Yeah.
Not being afraid to be open. And I think of conversation that way too. You have to risk saying something and someone not giving you the same warmth back, smiling and someone not smiling back, revealing a little detail about yourself and someone not choosing to reveal anything about themselves.
Right.
All of those things are cues. And we sometimes worry, I'm not going to get it back. But I actually see it differently. I see it as you'll get it back from people who are like you.
Right.
The kind of warmth that you want to bring into your world, you won't get it from everybody.
No.
But you'll get it from the right people. And that's how you'll know who your people are.
Right.
You'll know because of the way that you react. You become this beacon that other people like you will be like, oh, there she is.
Right, exactly. I think it's like what you talk about in your work a lot about. We spend so much time worrying about the people that are going to reject us, why they left us, why they ghosted us, why they didn't return the call. But I always say, and it sounds so cliche, but like, well, then they're not your person. They just did you a favor. Like the fact that they didn't call you back or the fact... Thank God it was only one date and it wasn't a year. But we spend so much time on that. I think, don't you? You've helped probably a lot of people. We can't make it as like a judgment about ourselves that we did something wrong, that we're a bad person. It kills me when people are like, oh, they just want to obsess for a week about someone they knew for a day. Or, but if we know that we did, like they would say, do the best you could, you know, you bring that out there, then it's like, nope, they're not my person. Or if they're not into what you, so I'm looking for a relationship right now and they're not. Let's say we said that. Great. So now you know, right? So
well, there are so many ways to unpack what you just said because
unpack it, Matthew.
If you take the scenario of falling in love too quickly,
yeah,
that can be a sign that someone's not ready for a real relationship. Because you can't possibly have fallen in love that quickly.
Yeah.
This isn't based on anything real. This isn't based on the actual person. It's not based on the qualities they really have. You can't base it on how great of a partner they are, because you have no idea what kind of a partner they are. You can't base it on the kind of person they are when you're sick and you need comfort, because you've never been through that together. You can't base it on the kind of support they give you when you get a promotion.
Right.
You can't base it on anything, because you literally know nothing.
But it feels so good. I feel so seen. When you get love bombed or whatever, that you think this is that connection. This is that person. But right.
No, the I feel so seen thing is one nice thing to have. But by the way, you also can't possibly have been that seen, because you can't possibly have conveyed that much in the space of a date or two.
Right. Right.
I forget where I heard this, but a date is your representative, yes, meets their representative.
Right.
Your bodyguard meets their bodyguard. You know, it's like you've put forward a version of you, but it's not the whole you.
Right.
There's a lot you held back. There's a lot that hasn't come out yet. So even if they made you feel so seen, they might be a wonderful listener. They might be an empath who can really connect with you, but you have no idea what kind of teammate this person is going to be, even if you feel seen.
Right.
You don't know that. And by the way, I don't say that to suck the romance out of early dating. Far from it. I think that it can be a wonderful thing, but it has to be tempered with the reality of where you're actually at. Be on the date you're on.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be on date two with someone else who's on date two, but really you're on date 52.
Is this like our future tripping where we picture that they're going to be Mr. or Mrs. Right, because we're going to have a whole life together. Just be present, pay attention to what's happening on the date.
Exactly.
I think that's part of it too, that I feel like, and I know we're talking in very heteronormative terms, I know this goes for everybody, but I was just telling some young women this who were just out of college, it was their first dates, and they were saying, like, they really wanted this guy to like, and they're like, oh, I hope he likes me, I hope this, I'm going to do this for the date, what should I wear, what should I say? And I was like, well, I think the most important thing is to pay attention to how you feel about them. Like, do you actually like him? I mean, I've done all the things, the mistakes where I was like, oh, I just want him to like me. So then I said to this woman, who was like her first real date, I was like, get into your body. Like, when you're there, think about, like, how do you actually feel with him? Because we get caught up in the, what does the aftermath mean? Did they text me? Did they not? Were they into me? But, you know, there's that part of it is be on the date you're on. Be present. What's happening? Like, what is the, do I feel good? Do I actually like this person?
Don't take 100% of what you should be doing from how you feel about him.
Okay.
How you feel about someone is very different from what they're doing in relation to you, or what they're giving to you, what they're investing in you. How you feel about someone is, it's like saying, how do you feel about your favorite actor?
Right.
They're the best.
Right.
I love them. Oh my God, they're so talented. They're so good looking.
Right.
They're so charismatic. That's how you feel about your favorite artist,
yeah,
writer, actor, whatever. That has nothing to do with you. It's separating how highly you think about a person in isolation,
mm-hmm,
from what you can actually build with them. Because what you can build with them is about the dance between the two of you. It's not about how wonderful you think they are. That's a completely different thing.
Right.
And people, you know, I've said it ad nauseum over my career. People invest based on how much they like someone. And you shouldn't invest based on how much you like someone. You have to invest based on the mutual exchange of investment,
okay,
that's happening between you. Invest in someone who invests in you. Now, look, in the beginning, someone has to move.
Right.
You can't just, if you sit around and say, I'm just going to wait for someone to invest in me, then you can have a stalemate.
Right.
Someone has to move. Someone has to say, hey, how are you? And then,
right,
oh, we have a conversation. Someone has to say, should we go out sometime? Oh, one of us asked the other one on a date. Someone has to say, I like you, before the other person says, I like you, and so on. There's always got to be someone who steps in.
She's
closer.
Moving it forward.
That's fine. That is a very small form of investment, but then you test. You invest and you test. You see, if I move forward, do you move forward? Or do you stand still? Or do you move backwards? And come to think of it, why do I find you more attractive when you move backwards?
Why though?
What's going on with me? Right. Groucho Marx said, I wouldn't want to be a member of any club that would have me as a member. Contained in that is the problem with most people's confidence in dating. You like me? There must be something wrong with you.
Right.
You don't want me? Well, now we're on to something.
Yeah, right. We're going to take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsors, but when we come back, Matthew breaks down how to stop dating people who aren't right for you and find a truly good match.
If they're not into me, it must mean they're more valuable than me.
Right. They're more valuable.
So I'm going to go after them. Or it must mean they're scarce. We want what's scarce. We value highly what is scarce.
No one's scarce.
Well, and here's,
there's so many people on the planet.
True.
Like,
that's true.
We put people on pedestals. Yeah.
And someone can just be, by the way, in a phase of not investing in their life. And then you come to take that as a measure of their worth. Meanwhile, here's the great irony of it. You could have someone who was the bad boy 5 years ago,
right,
but now has gotten to a stage of their life where they're like, you know what? That wasn't fulfilling me. I actually want to give to someone.
Yeah.
And then that man shows up and really meets this person head on. And she's like, why are you not making me?
Because she wants him to be the bad boy, or she heard.
Right. Like that, you're missing that thing. Right. And the irony is that maybe he was that thing at some point in his life, or he was that thing to somebody else yesterday, but now he turned around to meet you. And you know, we have a lot of issues that blind us to the fact that there's someone in front of us who's actually trying. You know, you said, what about when someone they were trying and now they're not, and that confuses us. We have to get to a point where we say consistency of behavior is going to be attractive to me.
Right. Okay.
I'm not going to do the calculation but last month,
right,
he said he liked me. Doesn't matter. What's he doing now? And what's he doing each week? Or she? You know, what is this person doing on a consistent basis? Because this thing of constantly second guessing if someone likes you, and someone who constantly makes you feel like you're second guessing yourself about whether they like you, what is that you're attracted to?
Right.
What is that you're into.
Some of us are, you know, our childhood traumas or issues we play in the relationship because we think that, we are not, well, I guess all of our greatest fears is that we're not lovable, mm-hmm. but we think, oh, I'm not lovable, or I have to, the chase, if it's hard, it means that it's worthwhile. If I had to chase it, or if someone makes me feel bad, that's familiar to how my dad made me feel. And so it's not conscious for many people,
and it's,
but that's
what
it is.
I need to close that loop.
Yeah.
I need to, you know, get some closure on the fact that my dad didn't give me that attention, and now I'm going to find someone else who's like him, but this time I'm going to get it. And the problem is, and the thing that, even though those things, you're right, are unconscious, once we start to realize them, we can say, well, what's happening here? I'm making my dad God.
Right.
I'm making my dad God in this situation. I'm looking at this person going, well, if only I could get their love. Well, who are they? They were a human, a flawed, screwed up human.
Right.
Not someone to run your life around trying to please, or trying to fix that hole that someone left behind. It's really, you know, part of growing up for all of us is recognizing just how human our parents were.
Right. They did the best they could.
Yeah.
They didn't know.
They did the best they could, and they may have been in so many ways just absolute train wrecks. And now you're running your life around trying to please a train wreck that imitates someone who was a train wreck growing up.
I would say you have to do the work. You have to do the work on yourself. Otherwise, you keep repeating patterns. You keep dating. Like, why do you, you know, I used to date the same guys over and over again. I was like, oh my God, they're the same, until I realized that, you know, I used to think they weren't available, but it turned out I wasn't emotionally available. Mm. You know, that's often what it is, you guys, if you haven't heard that. Like, if you keep dating people who aren't there, they don't show up, you're the common denominator, right? So I had to look at that. But how do you get people to do the work? I always say, when you break up with someone, don't jump right back into a relationship, but maybe look at yourself, look at the patterns. Like, how do you help people kind of look at those mistakes they're making in dating to make better choices in their next relationships or their next partners?
Well, I think some things are learned by dating a different kind of person than the person we normally date. I do think that you learn a lot from that experience, because you see a different way of loving. You know, if you suddenly start dating a person who, in an argument, handles an argument compassionately and doesn't try to cut you emotionally in an argument.
Right.
And you're arguing and they say, listen, I I really don't want you to feel that way. And I didn't mean that. And, you know, and they suddenly, like, you hear a new language around an argument. And they, you sort of, it's uncomfortable in the beginning. Because, like, no, this is where you say a really mean, nasty thing. And this is where I give you the silent treatment for the next 3 days.
Yeah.
And what's going on? And you start to at least hear and be present in a different language. Whether you can rise to the occasion is a different thing. But you learn a new reference point for how an argument can go. You know, now, you may not want to have to date to learn that lesson, but you can even learn that lesson by just surrounding yourself with new people in life.
Mm-hmm.
I believe so much in mentorship, whether it's formal or informal. People kind of take mentorship too literally.
Right.
They think a mentor is me finding someone in life and saying, will you be my mentor?
Right.
This person starts. It's a mentor is just anybody that you have some proximity to that is from a world or a life or a level of knowledge that you don't currently have.
Right.
And by osmosis can teach you something. And I've had the beauty of traveling in my life and meeting all sorts of different people and getting such different perspectives. And, you know, short of therapy, I applaud anyone who is brave enough to go through therapy. I think it's a tremendously difficult.
Have you had therapy?
Yeah, I
Good.
Still do therapy.
Good.
I see someone regularly because I don't, it doesn't matter what you know. We're so close to ourselves. We're so close to ourselves. I think I'm an incredibly self-aware person. I can still have someone who knows me well enough,
mm-hmm.
who's read my patterns, tell me something that I'm doing or have done that surprises me. And I go, man, I've always given myself such credit for
right.
being so evolved and so self-aware. And that just taught me something about myself that has been like a smack in the face. And I say that to people, you know, I do retreats every year and I say the same thing to people. This isn't about I know more than you.
Right.
This is about get outside yourself. Get someone who you trust, whose mind you value and respect, who can have a perspective on you that you cannot have on yourself. I could see my hands. You
right.
see me. I can't see me.
Right.
I see my hands and my legs. I
right.
seem to be in some sort of, you know, container walking around.
Yeah.
But I don't see what you see.
Right. We have to be open to that feedback.
You have to.
Yeah.
So even if you don't do therapy, put yourself around new people that challenge all of your ways of thinking and doing things. That's one of the ways to be more aware of your patterns.
Is that part of it? Tell me about your retreats, because I know that they're so successful. You've been doing them for a long time. It's mostly women,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a similar theme in all these years? Like, what is the most common thing that comes up in the retreats? What are we getting from it when we go?
So people, a lot of people think they're dating retreats, but they're actually not.
I know, that's what I love.
We don't even really talk about people's love lives on this retreat. We have some people who come from the perspective of saying, I have hit a point in my life where I have achieved an awful lot. I've achieved many of the things I thought would make me a more confident person. And I do not feel the confidence in myself that I thought I would feel by this stage. I thought my demons would go away with that promotion or that business.
They never go away. Okay. They just get smaller and you learn to deal with them. But anyway.
They suddenly wake up in a world where financially or in terms of their work, in terms of their status, even in their age, they're like, man, I'm at this age and I'm still paralyzed by this stuff. I'm still got imposter syndrome. I still don't feel mm-hmm. good enough. What is it going to take now to change that? And so we teach a model for confidence that changes that. I have other women who come, and men, because we now have a virtual retreat. So people do it from
That's
all
great.
Over the world.
Okay.
There will be people who say, I'm at a crossroads in my life. I want to actually know what to do next. I don't necessarily feel like my life has the purpose I want it to have. I don't even know what I'm passionate about and I want to throw myself into. I'm trying to figure out my direction.
After the break, Matthew opens up about the ways he's grown and changed in his relationships. Plus, he answers my 5 quickie questions. I'll be right back.
Okay, so you just said you do a confidence exercise. Because confidence, I guess people think, and I think I've heard you say this too. I was writing down a bunch of your quotes, but like, it's not like a light switch. You don't just like, I'm confident, check that box. It is a practice to be confident. And we all go through stages where we feel more and less so. So what's a confidence exercise?
So I teach a model on my retreat that shows how there are actually three different layers of confidence.
Okay.
Confidence isn't just this one. Confidence is defined in the dictionary as a feeling of certainty about something. But that doesn't give us the full picture on our own confidence. Our own confidence is divided into three layers, the first being the surface. That's how we come across, mm-hmm. how we walk, talk, act, and what that portrays about our level of confidence. And we all know that on some level that can be faked, although that's actually easier said than done.
Right.
But that's all the outward signs. We then have the lifestyle level. The lifestyle level is the things in our lives that underpin our confidence, at least, I suppose, on a egoic level.
Mm-hmm.
So you might be confident, and maybe not just on an egoic level, but even on a sort of a Maslow's hierarchy of needs on a security level.
Right. I have job, I have the car, I have the...
Correct.
I have
all these... Yeah, yeah. I have all these things that give me confidence. I have a dog I love. I have friends I love. I have great parents, or I know three languages, or I play an instrument, or it's all of these things that accumulate to kind of make us who we are and be able to say, look, I'm secure and safe and I'm a person of value. We know the dangers of that layer mm-hmm. of confidence.
It's fleeting. It's not away. Real, right?
Friends go, relationships go, our job can disappear, it can change.
You're canceled.
And we often on the lifestyle layer, we base an enormous amount of our lifestyle confidence in one or two main areas.
Right.
So if you have a relationship that you've made your entire world, then actually your lifestyle layer is not made up. It's made up of different things, but 90% of it is made up of this one thing.
Right.
And of course, we know what happens when that goes away.
Yeah.
It doesn't just feel like the death of a relationship. It feels like the death of us.
Right.
That's who we were.
Was like if you're going through a breakup, you mean, that relationship,
or whatever it may be.
Don't put all your eggs in any basket.
Right. And that's exactly it. On the lifestyle layer, people do put all of their confidence eggs in one basket.
Yes.
And that's why that area makes them particularly vulnerable. And it's why in a relationship, by the way, that person then has a kind of emotional gun to your head the whole time and is loaded by your own insecurity mm-hmm. because you can't bear the thought of them leaving, because them leaving is like a death of you.
Right.
So now you'll do anything to make them stay. And now you start dropping all of your boundaries,
right.
dropping all of your needs, subjugating yourself to them, doing right. anything you can to make them happy and so on. So on the lifestyle layer, it's about diversifying our confidence. And on the retreat, I take people through a very intense process of diversifying their confidence. Because it's not that whilst we can from a kind of enlightenment perspective say we shouldn't base any of our confidence on that egoic kind of identity driven level. It's just the construct. It's not really us and so on. But, you know, we live in a world where we do spend our time doing things and those things can give us confidence. But they're not a confidence that should be relied upon.
Right.
They're a luxury item.
Right.
Because the deeper level of confidence, that the essential item, is the third layer, and that's the core. And the core is one of the most profound things that I do with people on the virtual retreat or the in-person retreat. Our core confidence is about our relationship with ourselves. Mm-hmm. And what I do with people there is begin a new relationship with themselves. And for some people, begin a relationship because they've never had one.
Right.
They've had a relationship with the world. They've had a relationship with life. They've had a relationship with other people. But they've never had a relationship with themselves.
Right.
And that relationship is going to determine a whole lot about our lives.
Like they have negative self-talk, or they just don't really believe in themselves. They don't masturbate, for example. That's an important relationship.
But there's a disconnect there too.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
That's it.
So people on the core, even belief, if you think about it, even belief in ourselves, which is important. Belief comes from being able to do something, usually. It comes from having had reference points for the fact that I can do this. And some of us, there's areas where we haven't got reference points.
Right.
Like we might have every relationship we've been in, we got cheated on. And so when someone says, you have to believe that you can find a relationship with someone that won't cheat on you, it's like, well, tell me how to do that. Because every single relationship that person has cheated on me.
I get that all the time from people. Like, everyone cheats on me, or everyone this and that. It's like, well, clearly there's something that you're bringing to the table you're not seeing, but...
Well, there's something you're ignoring. But yes, I think in some ways, belief is overrated. The idea that we have to believe we can do something is overrated.
I think don't say just believe that you cannot be cheated on, to go back to your point.
I think that you have to change the idea that you can do something to the idea that it's necessary, that you have to. That when something is essential to your being, when something is essential to the way you want to live life, you no longer really have to worry about whether you can. You just you just do it. I mean, I was 21 when I lost out on a really big job interview.
Okay.
And I at the time, I was weighing up this job versus starting my own business. And I screwed up this interview royally. I mean, I went in and self-sabotaged the crap out of this interview. And they didn't give me the job. And all of a sudden, this option that I thought I had, should I start my own business?
Right.
Should I go and work for this big company? Oh, the choices. Suddenly, someone took away half the choice and said, well, you ain't getting that anyway. So now I went, I have to make this business work. It's essential. I have to. And that's a different feeling from, could I make this business work? Mm-hmm. And in our relationships, do you need to believe that you're not going to be cheated on? Not really. You just need to believe that a life where you don't take risks in love isn't a life worth living.
Yeah. To take risks and be okay with someone leaving you being hurt is part of it, right?
Yeah, but it's so hard.
It's so fucking hard.
It's so painful to be betrayed or to have your heart broken, to have someone, you know, to feel truly crushed by a situation is so painful. And it doesn't mean when that happens, you have to rush back out and do it all over again next month. But there gets to a point where it's almost not about whether you can trust people. It's about personal pride.
Okay.
It's about something bigger. It's that, yeah, someone can do that to me again. Of course they can. I can't stop that. But I have survived this before.
There's something to that.
I'm still here. I can keep going. And I have most likely new tools now.
Yeah. We learn the lessons from the past. We have to learn them now.
Yeah, I've learned lessons or I've gathered new intelligence or, and therefore I can do this again. It's not, this doesn't have to be a thing that breaks me. And even if it happens again, I can have true pride in the fact that I showed up. And I do think, I think there's something that's underrated about a situation where, you know, many people have been in a situation where they gave their all. Mm-hmm. To a relationship and were crushed in the process. Just someone steamrolled them and they never saw it coming. What's underrated, I think, is that those relationships where we truly give our all really can show the best of us. We get a chance to see who we can be when we're at our best, when we really are showing up to something.
Yeah.
And after a breakup like that, you get to look back on yourself and be proud of who you were. And what you gave and the way you were willing to show up.
Yeah.
That can make you like yourself more.
I guess that's why rock bottom, people say they hit rock bottom. It's when you really grow. I think that going through a breakup like that and realizing that you survived, that you've learned a lot, will make you so much stronger in another, in the next relationship.
And to then ask the honest question of yourself, which is, was there anything I was ignoring? If I really look at that now, what was I ignoring? What did I not speak up about?
Right.
And this is true in every relationship in our lives.
Even in work, like,
work,
what are you not saying?
You, I'm sure, have let go of people where you went, the thing I let go of them on, the thing, the reason I decided I didn't want them in my company anymore, I knew 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah, always. Yeah.
I knew that years ago, and I didn't talk to them. I didn't have the conversation. Or when it kept happening, I kept ignoring it. We had the conversation and then they did it again. And I just thought it was too much effort to bring it up again, you know, and or I said to myself, it'll go away on its own. Maybe they'll, you know, you can
it
see that. And it's, and it's a great lesson when you say, ah, well, I'm not crazy because I actually did see this, this, and this, and I chose to ignore it. Now that doesn't mean, it doesn't make them right. It doesn't excuse what they did, but what's going on with me that I chose to ignore that? Come to think of it, how many difficult conversations am I avoiding in my life?
That's a really good practice. I've been doing that lately too. I was reading some book about this on my trip, but it was like, make a list of all the conversations you're not having. And it's such a great practice. It really is.
Your life will improve in direct proportion to the number of difficult conversations you're willing to have.
Exactly. I guess what I keep going to is like when people say, oh, I broke up with this, or someone cheated on me. They think if someone cheats on them, or they're clearly toxic, then they have no responsibility in the relationship. We also need to look at, even if someone cheated on you and did something terrible, you're 50% of that relationship. There were some things you could still look at in yourself. I'm not saying you drove them to cheat, but what part of it did you accept? What part of it were you not addressing, right? So
I think that asking yourself the honest question all the time in any situation, what would I do differently faced with that situation again, faced with that relationship again? And my God, I mean, I've had my heart broken and then reflected on it and looked back and thought, well, okay, there were these things that I didn't agree with, or there are these things that, my God, that wasn't a very fair way for that to happen or this to happen or whatever. And that I wasn't responsible for, but I know that I would never do that again. Right. Or I know
like
that.
Like what? What are some of the things when you look back at Matthew dating 5 years ago that you wouldn't do now?
Good question. I could give you so many. If I look at the last 10 years of my life, there's been all sorts of different versions of me. In my 20s, you know, I always thought I was such a great guy.
They're like, this is my work. I work well with women.
Right. I thought I was a great guy. And I thought, you know, because I treated people, in one respect, I treated them well. I was respectful. I was generous. I was chivalrous. Mm-hmm. I've always been a kind person. I love people. I was raised to be kind. Mm-hmm. Kindness is like my highest value. But I was selfish.
Mm-hmm.
Not realizing how much I'd made everything about me.
Yeah.
Not realizing how careful, if you really are being a responsible adult, how careful you should be with people's hearts.
Right.
And how easily you can do damage with people's hearts.
Such a good consciousness to have right now, because I think a lot of us, I was not great to date years ago. You know, I think we all, but it's, I think it's when you don't have the answers to those questions, you're like, I'm still perfect. I'm still a perfect date, you know? I think we're always learning.
See, I look back now and I'm like, there's a part of me that goes, does casual dating actually exist?
Yeah, it exists, but does it work?
But if it doesn't work, it didn't exist.
Okay, got it. So tell me, let's talk about casual dating.
There's usually, most of the time, someone who's less casual than the other.
Yeah, there's always one person who wants more.
Yeah.
Always, yeah, yes.
And there's one person pretending to be more casual than they are.
Mm-hmm. That is true.
Because
that is true.
It gives
it's
me
like friends with benefits. People are like, that won't really work.
Oh, I'm just having a good time or whatever. And then your same friend who just said, I'm just having a good time, 4 weeks later is crying, going, what?
Yeah, you like, thought it was a good time.
I thought this was just a fun little jaunt you were having. But no, we do get invested very quickly, or one person gets invested very quickly.
Okay.
And we hear terms constantly, this hookup culture, hookup culture, hookup culture. There's certainly a decent amount of hooking up going on. But I question the idea that it's all so casual and carefree.
Okay.
Because I do think people get hurt more easily than we give it credit for.
Yeah.
And I know that in my life, there have been times where I've been willfully ignorant to how much my behavior might have affected someone.
Yeah.
How much I was ignoring how much someone liked me and what they wanted.
Yes.
And they weren't saying that they wanted all of that.
Right. But you just, we can tell.
You kind of know.
Yeah, we know.
And you continue entertaining the situation because it's fun. But you also know that week by week, you're on a track to hurting this person more and more, or vice versa. And, you know, I know that looking back now, you know, I'm glad of the person I am today and the lessons I've learned. But it's sad to me, people I hurt along the way.
Yeah.
And
but that's part of it.
Yeah,
I mean, I didn't know at the time, but I was like, I really used to say I don't want anything serious. And then I would probably act as if I did. And then I'd pull away. I guess I could have regrets about that. I could make amends. But I also think I've learned it's so not what I want. It's so not interesting. I didn't know myself well enough. I didn't want to get hurt. I can see all that now. So I think it's okay. I think as long as we evolve.
Lest I just sound like someone who's, you know, always been on the power position, I also can point to times in my life where, you know, I was too needy or too, you know, where my anxiety got the better of me.
Yeah.
And where I forgot myself. You know, I came out of a relationship and went, I was nowhere to be found. I had dismantled myself to please somebody, to try and be what I thought someone wanted, to run around their schedule, and you lose yourself. Mm-hmm. In the process.
Yeah.
And that's a sure sign that something is wrong. If you are losing yourself in a relationship.
Absolutely. I mean, I've definitely been there where I noticed that they were giving up their lives for me. They didn't have a lot of friends around.
So you were just always in the power position.
Yeah, because I was afraid of being hurt. I had a lot of stuff going on. I think I was a lot in the power position.
So did that manifest itself in sort of having a pattern of choosing people that were safe?
I think so, yeah. I chose people that were like into me, or they
couldn't hurt you because the dynamic was they were almost, they were more into you than you were into them.
I think so. Because there were things that were important to me. Like I needed to, I always dated very nice, good guys. Like I never was into like the bad boys or things that felt very unattainable, but I always dated guys that were right away, you know, they were just in, they were kind, they were good. But I think that I didn't know how to have difficult conversations. I didn't know what I wanted. I didn't know how to really be in a relationship for a long time. I mean, that's why I started this career, because I was like, I do not want to repeat that. What is wrong with me that sex didn't say is interesting after a while, sex got boring, that I thought that half the marriages end in divorce, sex is often one of the problems. Mm-hmm. I was like, I want to learn how to not be that.
Given that you started from a position of talking about all this stuff at a time when you were like,
myself,
looking for something, a different pattern than you were experiencing, mm-hmm. what was it like for you running those two things in tandem, talking about the subject whilst also sort of living it?
I was going to ask you the same thing, because I've grown up doing this show. I think it's been, and I didn't say I was the expert before I felt the expert. Like early, I was like, you're the expert. I'm like, I'm learning with everybody. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's always a challenge to walk the line and to be like, well, here's what I'm going through. I'm human too. I'm struggling, or I'm in a relationship that's ended and that's really hard, but I'm here to help you. Like, how do you show? You probably going through a heartache and they have to show up at a retreat. You're like, I'm fucking miserable, but I'm here to help you. So I just think when you're in the healing professions or the helping professions, we're also human. Like, your therapist isn't perfect. They don't sleep in the office. They have like a bad, you know, you always think like, your therapist is just sitting there all day there to serve you. But that's part of being human. Like, I think I've learned so much. I wouldn't want to date me who I was 15 years ago. But now it's like, I feel like I've learned about, I think most of it's communication. I didn't know how to have different conversations. I would always fake a lot of things, fake orgasms, fake whatever. I just want people to like me. You know, it's just so different now. Now I'm like, I'm so equipped to have open conversations and to love and be loved.
I feel that.
And I know my
issues,
and I talk about my issues. I'm like, this is where I struggle. Like, I think it's okay. I think I used to think it wasn't okay to talk about. You probably get this a lot, like afraid of being needy or afraid of being like, I was the anti needy. I was like so independent, and I still am. I think that that's a challenge. I'm like, you're so independent, but like, I want to be loved. I want to be in a relationship, you know? So it's just.
But it makes for a very three dimensional person coming out the other side of that. Because, of course, you still have access to all of those very strong parts of you. But when you then couple that with the softness of being able to be vulnerable or be open about yourself, or the warmth, or the even being self-deprecating or whatever, it creates a very attractive three-dimensional picture that we don't have when we're trying to be a caricature.
That's it for this episode, but subscribe and stay tuned for part two of my interview with Matthew Hussey when we get into how to tell if your partner is actually invested in your relationship. We talk about love bombing and how to spot authenticity on a date, the importance of consistency. Oh, we cover a lot, so be sure to subscribe for the next episode. Thanks for listening to Sex with Emily. Be sure to like, subscribe, and give us a review wherever you listen to podcasts, and share this with a friend or a partner. Believe me, if you got something out of this, they will too. We release 2 to 3 episodes a week. Find me on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. It's all at Sex with Emily. If you want to ask me a question about sex, dating, or relationships, you can email me feedback@sexwithemily.com or sexwithemily.com/askemily. And check out my website. We have so many articles on there helping you better sex. And you can check out our guides at sexwithemily.com/guides for free guides that will give you expansive tips and activities. Sign up for our weekly emails because, hey, I've been told I give really good emails. Was it good for you? Email me feedback@sexwithemily.com.